This is
KUT.
KUT, Austin.
Stop.
This is KUT Weekend for the third weekend of August 2018. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5, the NPR station in Austin, Texas. Here's what we got for you this week. Armed school marshals heading back to school.
Intense training. That's what we've been through this week. Very stressful. Stressful situations, mental and physical.
After decades apart, Mexican parents reunited with undocumented children in Round Rock.
Niña, mi hermana. Hermana mía.
And a veteran audio engineer obsessed with high-quality analog sound.
Now my life is complete. I have the perfect amplifier, and I have the perfect sound system.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend. A Major League Soccer team is one step closer to coming to Austin. As KUT's Saida Hassan reports, the Austin City Council has voted to move forward with an agreement for a new stadium here for a team now in Ohio called the Columbus Crew.
Today's vote clears the way for Precourt Sports Ventures to bring a 20,000-seat stadium to the McCallow Place site near the Domain. Precourt owns the Columbus Crew soccer team and wants to relocate them from Ohio to Texas. At today's meeting, council members voted 7-4 in favor of the agreement. Austin Mayor Steve Adler says the plan will have a significant public benefit.
The soccer team is paying for and they're building a stadium, and then they're giving it to us for free. And then they're paying us rent to use it.
The decision came after about 5 hours of discussion as council members worked through several amendments related to parking, transportation, affordable housing, and youth soccer programs. Saida Hassan, KUT News.
The state of Texas has a new accountability system for schools and school districts that awards a grade of A through F. The largest school district in the Austin area, Austin ISD, got a B. As KUT's Claire McInerney reports, when it comes to individual schools, some are failing.
This is the first year the Texas Education Agency is issuing A through F grades for districts. Previously, schools and districts were ranked under a pass-fail system, earning either a meet standard or improvement required distinction. The new A through F system applies only at the district level this year. Individual schools still received one of those two rankings. At a press conference today, AISD Superintendent Paul Cruz said he was proud of the B grade the district earned.
We know we're sharing some good news around many of our schools in our district, but I know that we still have work to do. We did have 5 schools that did not meet state performance standards and are rated as improvement required.
Those 5 schools are Mendez Middle School, Wyden Elementary, Bertha Sadler Means Young Women's Leadership Academy, and 2 alternative campuses, Rosedale School and Graduation Prep Academy at Travis High School. Schools will receive their A through F grades next year. Claire McInerney, KUT News.
A lot of kids in Texas went back to school this week. Others will return next week. And over the summer, the state has been looking at ways to improve school safety. Those efforts came after the shooting at Santa Fe High School, a little bit outside Houston. That was in May. 10 people were shot dead. 13 others were wounded. As KUT's Matt Largy reports, a state program to train armed school employees has grown, potentially doubling the number of these so-called school marshals.
2 people wearing black protective face masks make their way down a school hallway. On their left, a classroom door. They move in, guns drawn. They move around the classroom, searching for any signs of danger.
Clear.
Under the desks, in the corners, they're looking for an armed intruder.
Go ahead and exit. Clear to your left.
Finding nothing, they move on, peering around the corner into the hallway to scan for threats.
Clear.
All right.
In the hallway, their instructor calls an end to the simulation. Soon, they could be carrying real guns in their own schools, potentially defending their students from a shooter. They're part of a recent training just outside Austin for the Texas School Marshal Program, which has been around since 2013.
It was slow at first, but especially after Santa Fe, it's just pretty much exploded.
Kim Vickers is the executive director of the Texas Commission on Law Enforcement. He's got 38 years as a police officer. His agency runs the school marshal training program. As of last week, there were 71 school marshals across Texas. Another 94 are in the process of getting trained or appointed.
And we have more people wanting to do it than we have ability to train so far.
Teachers or any other school employee can be appointed as a marshal by their school board. It's voluntary. They need to have a license to carry a handgun. They also get a psychological exam. Then, 80 hours of training.
Intense training. That's what we've been through this week. Very stressful situations, mental and physical.
School marshals are supposed to be anonymous, so we're not using this Southeast Texas school board member's name or his district. The training includes things like legal liability, police tactics, and firearms.
Now, it's a crash course, but we're going through police training course. How to handle your weapon. I've been around weapons my whole life. I've shot my whole life, and I learned a tremendous amount this week.
All right, make sure your mask.
Of course, the actual shooting part of the training might be the most important. Two marshals in training line up at the end of a long hallway, guns drawn.
On your go!
And then a group of about a dozen or so trainees run away from the shooting. The marshals move toward it. As the gunman comes around the corner, the marshals take aim. The gunman falls. These kinds of simulations are, at least in part, supposed to force trainees to come to grips with something that might seem kind of obvious.
You've got to face this. As a person that's going to be carrying this gun, you've got to face the idea that you may have to shoot somebody. And can you do that?
Again, Kim Vickers.
If you're a teacher, this may be a kid that is in one of your classes, and you know this kid, and suddenly you're looking at them, looking down a gun that they have, and you've got to get through the idea that I can take this action if I need to.
I don't know that anybody truly knows what you would do when you're in that situation. We would all like to think that we would do what we need to do to keep everyone safe.
This marshal in training is an administrator at a school in Southeast Texas. He says confronting the idea of actually using deadly force is a hard thing for educators.
When your family or those that you're responsible for at a school are presented with a danger, and that danger may be somebody that you actually know, and you've got to make a critical life or death situation, it's just, those are decisions that are hard to fathom.
And some trainees find out they don't want to make those decisions.
We've had them walk away from the training, which is good. They don't need to be doing it if they don't feel like they can do that.
The school marshal program's been controversial ever since it was proposed. Teachers and teachers' unions have consistently opposed the idea of bringing more guns into the classroom.
We see this as a short-term fix for really a long-term issue.
Noel Candelaria is the president of the Texas State Teachers Association. He says it might make sense in some rural places where police response times may be long, but ideally he'd like more state funding for things like school resource officers.
Look, teachers don't want guns in the classroom. Teachers that we've talked to, that I've talked to since the day after Santa Fe, overwhelmingly teachers don't want guns in the classroom. They want trained professionals. They don't want the responsibility of carrying guns themselves.
I hear people saying, that's not the answer. More guns is not the answer. I agree.
But Kim Vickers argues it's part of the answer.
If we're going to make our school safer, it's a layered process. Because the true place to really start is not putting guns on campus. The true place to really start is looking for these issues ahead of time, addressing these kids that are marginalized and working with them before it ever gets to that point.
The Texas legislature will consider new school safety measures when it meets early next year, things like redesigning schools and bolstering mental health and early intervention programs. In the meantime, some are looking at Texas's school marshal program as a model to replicate in other states. Matt Largy, KUT News.
Austin is often referred to as one of the country's most economically segregated cities, and it's a conclusion that is largely driven by research. But part of that disparity is highlighted in the lack of a computer and internet access. KUT's Avery Miles reports on how the city is trying to address this digital divide.
A few years ago, Jan Morgan didn't know how to use a computer beyond opening and deleting her emails. Her son had taught her the basics, but she still refused to get a smartphone, despite his advice.
And he always said, Mother, you need to know how to use a smartphone. And I told him I did not want a phone smarter than me.
So she bought flip phones and prepaid phone cards instead. A lot of them.
33 phones. Just buying a new phone to get the card. And because I thought, okay, that phone's no longer any good. So I just kept buying phones and cards and phones and cards like that.
Finally, a couple of years ago, the energetic 56-year-old signed up for the Austin Housing Authority's Digital Ambassador Program. There she learned things like how to use a computer to watch the news and visit faraway places like Australia. She also discovered she could do a lot of those things on a smartphone, too. Soon she started teaching other seniors in her building.
Because you really want everybody to be empowered so they know how to do what we're doing so no one's falling behind. And a lot of the seniors have fallen behind because they said it was only for young people, and they told me that. I used to think that too. I said, but it's not just for us. It's not just for them, it's for us.
But before you learn how to use a computer, you've got to have access. And that's where Austin has a real problem. A 2014 survey found 55,000 adult Austinites did not have a home computer or internet connection. John Spears is the manager of the city's digital inclusion program.
We have a digital divide here in the Austin community.
But the disparity doesn't end with technology. A couple of years ago, a research project by the University of Toronto designated Austin as the most economically segregated city in the U.S.
That is something that Mayor Adler said at the time. That is the number one list that we do not want to be number one on.
Spears and his team are trying to bridge both gaps by partnering with several nonprofits to hook up more Austin residents with internet connections and refurbished computers. Catherine Crago heads up the strategic initiatives for the Austin Housing Authority. She says the cost of connectivity for low-income people is not often considered.
So there is no standard measure for the cost of communications. HUD says that 30% of income should be spent on rent, 10% should be spent on transportation, but no one has defined how much communication should cost.
She says people let their internet go because the monthly fee goes up or they have to pay for a $75 tooth cavity. Sometimes they get into internet debt. She says families without home internet sometimes drive to McDonald's and sit idling while their children use the free wireless connection inside the restaurant. In a state where legislators have mandated digital literacy in schools, that image might seem a bit off. Again, Catherine Crago.
And in a smart city, when that front door of a government agency becomes a web portal, how would our residents use those services? How would they access that front door? Using the internet, using a smartphone or a computer.
Back in the community room at her Lakeside apartment building, Jan greets some of her students as they walk in.
And that's Mary. She's one of my students. Hi.
She says empowering other people like her has been great.
It's a whole new world. Mm-hmm. And it's wonderful. Mm-hmm.
Thanks to Jan and other teachers like her, over 1,000 Hawker residents have participated in digital literacy training, and almost 900 have earned a computer, laptop, or a smartphone. Avery Miles, KUT News.
Families from Mexico were reunited last week in Round Rock. It was arranged as part of a program for parents living in Mexico who have children settled in the United States but are not able to visit each other for immigration reasons. KUT's Ashley Lopez was there.
This is the moment Rosa Barriga Barriga saw her sister and her adult children for the first time in a really long time. You can hear the moderator of the event ask, how long has it been since you've seen each other? Rosa's sister told her, 24 years. And in front of this big room surrounded by family, Rosa turned to her children. My daughter, she yells. Antonio, who is this kid? Rosa asks. I don't recognize you anymore, my son, she says. Every one of the more than 30 families at this event had emotional reunions like this. There were a lot of kids and grown adults breaking down at the sight of their parents. Most of these families hadn't seen each other in more than a decade, sometimes two. This reunification was made possible by the Consulate General of Mexico in Austin and the government of the state of Michoacán. This program, which is called Palomas Mensajeras, or Homing Pigeons, holds events like this all over the country. This was their first in the Austin area.
They chose Round Rock because there's a significant community from Intunsan here, And this was a very important concentration of people from Michoacán.
That's Carlos González Gutiérrez. He's the Consul General of Mexico in Austin. He says in order for parents living in Mexico to qualify for this program, they have to be more than 60 years old. They have to have a clean record, and they also had to show that they have children living in the U.S. At the end of it, they get a tourist visa that lasts 10 years. It allows them to travel to the U.S. for 6 months at a time.
Through this system, they allow for a more natural, more normal, more constant, more fluent way of meeting each other in the U.S.
The families living in and around Round Rock pay for the full cost of all this. And while visas and travel can be pretty pricey, the alternative is much harder. Gutierrez says without this program, many of these folks would not be able to see their aging parents.
The common denominator is that all the relatives here are undocumented. And so they cannot go back and forth. They come here, and once they are in the U.S., it's so expensive and so dangerous to cross the border that they have to stay in the U.S.
And he says that comes with a significant cost. For example, the only member of Rosa Barriga Barriga's family living in the U.S. that has been able to visit her has been her 17-year-old niece, Andrea Orozco. She was born in the U.S. and has no problem traveling in and out of the country. While she sat with her family waiting to see her aunt, Orozco says she's watched her mother miss her sister and other siblings.
It's very hard. I've seen times where our family over there is like suffering or something is happening, and my mom, she can't really do anything about it. She's just sitting there hoping for the best. She prays for them and all. She just hopes that everyone is doing okay.
And it's also been hard on her aunt's children, who are adults now. Maria is one of Rosa Barriga Barriga's 8 children. While she sat waiting to see her mother, she could barely talk about how she felt. There's a lot of mixed feelings, she says. Maria told me she's happy to finally see her mom, but it's also sad to think about all the time that's gone by and her mother hasn't been there. And that's why Consul General Carlos González Gutiérrez says the program was created. It was a way to address a problem that faces a lot of Mexican nationals who move to the U.S. without documentation.
This is the real cost of immigration. People sometimes don't see it, but the human cost behind each family that is separated is the highest cost that a person pays for migrating to another country. It shows that migrants leave their country not willingly, but as a result of the need.
Gutierrez says this event is particularly stark against the backdrop of family separations at the U.S.-Mexico border earlier this summer. He says the anxiety among the families in this event is palpable.
They know that climate has changed significantly and that these type of opportunities are going to be very, very rare.
But Gutierrez says in the meantime, this event was a breath of fresh air. Ashley Lopez, KUT News.
The Austin City Auditor's Office is investigating various parts of the city's Vision Zero plan. That's a comprehensive traffic safety plan that council members passed in 2016. So in its first report, the auditor considered how the Austin Police Department handles traffic enforcement. KUT's Audrey McGlinchey has that.
There are several things that limit APD's ability to enforce traffic laws. Hiring vacancies, for one. But also, last year, Austin had to remove more than 400 of its police vehicles from the road after it discovered carbon monoxide had been leaking into the cars and making some officers sick. The audit also considered how the city's red light cameras affect traffic enforcement. Since 2008, the city's installed 10 cameras at 9 intersections. These intersections have seen a significant decrease in crashes. The city's currently considering relocating cameras and even adding more. Mayor Pro Tem Kathy Tovo suggested the city add them to those flashing stoplights around the city. They're called pedestrian hybrid beacons.
In my district, I'm hearing a lot of concerns about people racing through the pedestrian beacons. And in fact, you know, one of them that I'm aware of that I received a concern about a few weeks ago has had several crashes there recently.
The auditor's office says it'll also write reports about other parts of the city's Vision Zero plan, including education and engineering efforts. Audrey McGlinchey, KUT News.
Our AT Explained project is on a bit of a hiatus over the summer, a vacation, if you will. But we have been listening back to some of our favorite stories of the past year. So now we're going to hear the mystery of the airport map. On the floor of Austin's airport, there's a map made up of terrazzo tile. Represents our city, but not quite as it is today. When a listener noticed, she wrote our AT Explained project to ask what it meant. As KUT's Mose Bouchel tells us, it starts with some strange street names and gets weirder from there.
Airports are busy places. Some people are rushing to their flights. Other people just landed. They're trying to get home. Who has the time to look at the public art? Well, meet Arcelia Hernandez.
So we had arrived.
She says it was her kids who pointed out the terrazzo map installed in the floor of the baggage claim.
I wouldn't have noticed it, but you know, children are closer to the ground and they're always reading their environment.
It's a big map, downtown Austin.
We began to read the map, just for fun.
At first glance, it looks like a pretty faithful representation, except for the street names.
And then I noticed the misspellings.
They're all wrong.
Here's San Jacinto, and so it has San Jacinto.
With an extra N.
Here's Brazos.
With two S's instead of a Z.
Here's La Vaca.
There's a B where there should be a V.
Here's Guadalupe.
Spelled the way some people still pronounce it in town.
Guada and L-O-U-P, Guadalupe.
Hernandez is a bilingual ed professor. This one really bothered her.
And so to have Guadalupe, which is like a pretty important name historically, to be misspelled, I don't know. I find this disturbing.
All right, let's keep looking because there's actually more here.
Oh, really?
Closely.
Yeah.
Look closely at Nueces.
Oh, my goodness.
It's got an extra E in it.
See, I totally missed that. Nueces? Okay, so what happened here? What is this about?
Take a close look at Sabine.
Sabine with the E at the end?
Look at the end.
Oh, my dear. Sabine?
Sabine.
Okay, so what happened here, Mouse?
Well, it's an old story and not always a happy one.
You can imagine him seething or certainly feeling jealous.
But we're getting a little ahead of ourselves. I
mean, should we get to the rest of that story?
Let's go back to the map for a second. Okay. Turns out the map on the Austin airport floor is a recreation of the first map ever drawn of Austin. It was commissioned in 1839 before Texas was part of the U.S. President Maribo Lamar chose this place to be the capital of the new Republic of Texas.
Lamar picked a man named Edwin Waller to come up here and build this place.
By the way, this is Jeffrey Kerr. He's a local historian and author. He says Waller brought a team of 200 men, both free and enslaved. They had about 5 months to build a city from scratch.
The first thing he had to do, of course, was lay out the streets. They decided immediately to put the city between the two main creeks, which were Waller Creek and Shoal Creek.
So he got to name a creek after himself.
I don't know if he did that himself, but somehow he ended up with that.
But the important guy here isn't Waller. It was a surveyor on Waller's team named L.J. Pillier. He's the guy who drew the first Austin map. Who was he?
Well, he might have been from New Orleans.
He's referred to in letters as a Creole.
Pillier first came to Houston,
where he got into some financial trouble.
He went bankrupt there, and a couple of boats that he owned that were on the bayou were seized by the local sheriff in 1839. This was at about the same time that he was up here in Austin laying out the city streets.
Drawing the map of Austin was really important work. Back then, Texas had no money, but a lot of land. The government needed the map to sell lots in Austin to fund itself. Not everyone liked the idea. Sam Houston hated it.
And that was one of Houston's criticisms, was this is just a massive scam for a lot of people to make money on real estate deals, which it kind of was.
They named the east-west streets after Texas trees. They were later changed to numbers. And the north-south streets after Texas rivers, like they are today. Except on the Pillier map, they're spelled differently. Many, just like they are on the floor of the airport.
Here's Brazos.
It's spelled B-R-A-S-S-O-S on Pillier's map.
And here you have it with two S's. Here's La Vaca.
Which is spelled on the original map from Pillier as La Vaca, L-A-B-A-C-A.
And in Spanish, B and V, there's no sound of the V.
That makes a lot of sense to me.
But then there's Guadalupe. Nothing like the Spanish.
That one's kind of an important one.
That one I don't really know. All I can say is that spelling was very fluid back then.
But there is a reason he spelled it that way.
Guadalupe. Oh, yes, yes. So they had the... Is that an OU?
Yeah.
Should be an OU. Looks like an E.
This is Lars Henriks. He's a linguist at UT Austin, and he runs the Texas English Linguistics Lab.
Yeah, we study everything about Texas language.
He says the reason it's spelled Guadalupe with an L-O-U-P is simple. It's the way Anglos said the word. At the risk of oversimplifying the science here, it was easier for them. So Pillier, who seemed to spell some other streets phonetically, spelled Guadalupe as the city founders spoke it, and as a lot of people still do. And that means when you hear people say Guadalupe in Austin, well, they're butchering the Spanish, but they're also staying true to the way Pillier named the street on the first ever Austin map.
Maybe to say, yeah, the Anglos are doing it too. I don't know.
Yeah.
We cannot know.
No.
Somebody should have asked him.
But Pillier didn't stick around long enough to ask.
Next came selling the lots off. I mean, this is how the government was going to raise money to actually pay for everything that they were doing.
Here's Jeffrey Kerr again. He says, on August 1st, 1839, Austin's founders held an auction to sell the land.
Real estate speculation.
Yeah.
We hear about it in Austin today, and it's been with us since the beginning.
It's one way of looking at it.
It happened under two big oak trees that still stand in Republic Square downtown.
You know, most of the people involved in building Austin participated and bought something. The auctioneer, for example, bought a couple lots.
He also made about $9,000 commission.
Some of the other surveyors bought lots. Most of the politicians are going to be here bought lots.
But one person didn't.
Pillier didn't buy anything. And I think the reason is, as I pointed out, he was bankrupt. He didn't have any money.
If you remember, his boats had been seized to pay debts back in Houston.
You can imagine him seething or certainly feeling jealous. That would be a normal emotion as he's watching all these people who were buying lots left and right, and he's the guy that drew the map, and he couldn't buy anything.
A short time later, the auctioneer realized he was missing over $3,000 of his commission.
They traced it back to Pillier. They caught him with the money. They held an impromptu kangaroo court, convicted him, and then flogged him, and then drove him out of town. So within a short period of time after drawing this beautiful plat of Austin, Pillier was leaving town in disgrace.
Kerr thinks Pillier likely made it back to New Orleans, where he found success as a surveyor. That's the end of his story here, but it's not the end of ours.
So here's San Jacinto.
You see, some of the misspellings on the map of the airport don't match Pillier's original spellings.
And so it has San Han Cinto.
Look closely at Nueces.
See, I totally missed that. Nueces? Sabinf?
Sabinf.
Okay, so what happened here, Mo?
Yeah, I'm surprised it's taken this many years to come up.
This is Jerry Ludwig. He lives in Houston now, but he was one of the men who designed and installed the Terrazzo map at the airport in 1999.
It was a big project for us at the time.
He says he had to clear the plans for the map with the city. And when he got the design back, the street names had been changed.
And when I seen that, I called him. I was like, you know, what is this? you know, because much like everybody else that looks at it that notices it goes, that's wrong.
The city explained this is how the street names appeared in the original 1839 map.
And, you know, my first question was, well, who's around from 1839 to know this?
But he says the city was insistent. So he laid the tiles exactly as they were spelled on the design he had been given.
Oh, yes. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Because it was really, really, really went over and back over so many times by so many different people.
The errors were caught after the job was done. In a short news report in 1999, the Austin Chronicle talked to Janet Siebert, the airport's cultural coordinator, about it. I tried to interview her, but the city's cultural arts division wouldn't let me. In the Chronicle story, she said the misspellings were going to be fixed, but almost 20 years later, they haven't been, and they probably won't be.
Yeah, that's the great thing about Terrazzo.
It lasts a long, long time. Moz Bushel, KUT News.
Amplify their on-stage sound. Austin musicians often rely on analog gear that is sometimes decades older than the musicians themselves. When this vintage gear needs tube replacement or a tune-up, some musicians turn to this 65-year-old veteran audio engineer.
No, I'm just going to make a cup of coffee. This is my decaf coffee with my phony sugar and my phony lightener. You get old, this is what you have to put up with. I'd offer you some of this, but it's really not good. My name is Jack Donahue, and I run a business down here known as Audio Tech Austin. I started this business in my South Boston apartment in 1986. Audio Tech Austin specializes in the repair and service of tube guitar amplifiers and the repair of high-end audio equipment. Why don't we head into the music listening room? There's the couch. Have a seat, and I'll pull up a chair, and I'll be with you in a second. So I was 24, 25 years old. I was making equipment for the likes of the Rolling Stones, Kiss. Then at night, I was going on the Boston scene, and I was mixing sound for Boston punk bands. Back then, I was still doing special projects for Aerosmith. That was my claim to fame. When we get done with this, I'd love to have you give the amp a listen. Tell me what you think of it. Now, this is the amp that I built. This is all analog. I'm going to turn it on. I'll just let this speak for itself. The idea when I built that amplifier was to build an amplifier that I could listen to a benchmark song like Led Zeppelin's Stairway to Heaven or Pink Floyd Dark Side of the Moon and hear things that I'd never heard before. Hear it clearer and liver, be able to dim the lights down. I joke with my friends about it. I say, well, now my life is complete. I have the perfect amplifier and I have the perfect sound system. But I was a troubled kid and I didn't get along well with my peers. So I was a geeky kid. I was the kind of kid that would follow what we called back then tube jockeys. Tube jockeys were the guys that worked in the radio, TV, repair shops as the service call, the runners. I was going to Boston Latin School. The kids were going to be lawyers or doctors. I had no interest in that at all. I liked rock and roll. I loved listening to the radio, and I love good sound. And that's where that started. And while everybody was studying science, I was sitting there looking out the window at these radio towers at an adjacent parking lot, dreaming about being a DJ, and I was jotting down schematics to Fender amplifiers. And the science teacher was always very upset with me. They suggested that instead of attending science class each day, that I go to the library and study electronics. Anyways, what happened was I mixed a few bands in high school, and then when I got out of high school, I opened up my own shop, and my first customer was Harvard University. I worked 2 days a week at Harvard as a subcontractor, and then I started working in Fender amplifiers. I have amplifiers that Fender amps come in here all the time, 50, 60 years old. They've been through three or four generations. I'm making an amplifier that you can give to your son or your daughter, and they can give to their kid, and it's still going to run. This is my legacy, because I don't have any kids. I don't have any family. This is what I'm leaving behind.
Was produced by Rachel Rasko for NPR's Next Generation Radio Project. That was a week-long digital journalism training that happened at KUT this past week, and it gave a handful of young journalism students and recent grads a chance to report and produce their own multimedia story. Each one was paired with a journalist. I got paired with Rachel for this story. You can read more of her reporting on Austin's music scene in the Austin Chronicle. That's K. KUT Weekend for the third weekend of August 2018. You can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org. You can email any questions or comments to weekend@kut.org. Or just ask me on Twitter. I'm @KUTNathan. Our theme music is by RAC. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org.